Life Audio.
Howdy, friends. Heather Creekmore here. Today I'm going to let you have a little something bonus, a little peek behind the curtain, if you will. So as most of you know, I'm walking through the 40-day body image workbook with about 90 women. It's been amazing. And we're having some amazing conversations because we got to the third week of content. And the third week of content is when I dig into food and diet culture. And a lot of it was probably new for many of my readers because, you know, I do talk about food and intuitive eating and diet culture a little bit on the show, but, you know, mostly I've been more focused on body image just in and of itself. But these 7 days of the 40-day book really challenge kind of everything maybe you've learned or thought or were taught or, you know, assumed you knew about dieting and weight control and what really happens when you go on a diet and what weight loss really is and all these things. And so it was really edgy and we had some really good conversations. And so I felt like I needed to kind of do a special recording to tie up some of the loose ends from conversations we had in our discussion groups. And so I don't know, it ended up being about 30 minutes long. And I thought, you know, maybe this would just be a good podcast because maybe you've been reading those pages in the workbook too and had some questions, or maybe you even just listened to Tuesday's podcast where I talked about the low carb fraud and you're like, I just don't know if I believe that. Like, this is all really feeling uncomfortable to me. So here's more. Here's more content to maybe rock your world in terms of how you think about food and dieting and eating and diet culture and all those things. So again, my heart is not that you're going to listen to this and be like, I totally agree with Heather. My heart is really just to encourage you to think, to maybe see things in a different way, to maybe not assume that the way you've always thought about these things, because this is the way culture has taught us, and probably your parents too, have taught us to always think about these things. Maybe challenge those notions a little bit. And you can do your own research, of course. But that's my heart here. So I hope that you enjoy this. Hey, if you're reading the 40-Day Body Image Workbook and you are like a normal human being who has a hard time getting through all 40 days of something by yourself without community, like, I get that. That would be me too. Although candidly, I'd probably just read through the book as a book and skip all the exercises, which would be skipping the point because it's a workbook for a reason. I want you to do the hard work and get free. But I know myself and I know it'd be hard to do it on my own. And so that's why I want to invite you to walk through it with a group. Starting at the end of May, right before Memorial Day, we are going to do another 40-day challenge. It's going to end before July 4th week. So if you have vacation plans that week, that's fine. But really, if you have vacation plans anytime in there, I record the sessions. So you'll miss out on community for 1 week, but you're not going to get behind. So I would encourage you, consider walking with a group of like-minded Christian women on this 40-day journey this summer. It's going to be going up on the website really soon for you to go ahead and reserve your spot there, but I'm telling you about it early. And if you want to make sure you get the information about it, feel free to drop me a message at heather@comparedtowho.me. I'm glad you're here. Please let me know what you think of this episode. And hey, if you haven't reviewed the show yet, this would be a great time. That helps others find this show as a resource. So leave your review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. That would be a huge blessing to me. Okay, let's get to today's show. Welcome to Compared to Who, the podcast to help you make peace with your body so you can savor God's rest and feel His love. If you're tired of fighting body image the world's way, Compared to Who is the show for you. You've likely heard lots of talk about loving your body, but my goal is different. Striving to fall in love with stretch marks and cellulite is a little silly to me. Instead, I want to encourage you and remind you with the truth of Scripture that you are seen, you are known, and you are loved no matter what your size or shape. Here, the pressure is off. If you're looking for real talk, biblical encouragement, and regular reminders that God loves you and you're not alone, you've come to the right place. I hope you enjoy today's show, and hey, tell a friend about it. Hey, friends, what a week we've had discussing food stuff. And I know this is challenging for so many of you. And I just want to remind us all of grace, 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 grace. And we're going to talk about grace more at the end of this. And I want to be just so delicate in how I approach these issues. So we talked about emotional eating. That was kind of a big thing that came up on Tuesday night's group. Thursday night, we kind of talked about emotional eating some, or Thursday afternoon, not Thursday night. We talked about emotional eating some more, but we kind of talked more about this dichotomy of turning to God and not to food and some of the messaging we've heard from the church around that. I'm not going to be arrogant enough to believe that I'm going to set everything straight with this one message. Y'all, this is hard stuff. Most of us have lived in diet culture and even diet culture in the church for so many decades. It's really difficult to change the way we've believed on some of these issues. And actually, later in this book, we talk about changing belief systems and kind of how we change those neural pathways in our brain, that sort of thing. But this is a process. And some of you have been on this process, on this journey for a longer time than others. Some of you are still very much in a dieting state of mind. Maybe you're on a diet right now, and that's okay. There's grace for you wherever you're at. My goal is just to kind of make you think. No matter where you're at, I just want you to consider some alternative ways of thinking about things and also hear what I believe is some biblical truth. And so that's where we're going. Here's the biggest challenge, I think, for those of us that have body image issues and those of us who like diets, right? We like diets because they tell us when we are right or wrong. They're black and white. We like rules. We like to know when we've succeeded and when we failed. And, you know, someday I'm going to do a study on personality traits of someone with body image issues, but I feel like this is something that we all have in common. It also feels really uncomfortable to think about being free with food. We long for rest, don't we? But we believe that it's something we have to work to earn. When we get the body we want, when we've done the work that we're supposed to do with our food, we've done all the things and get what we want, then we will deserve a rest. And that's why most women go on diets. They just want to stop worrying about food, stop thinking about all the time. So they go on a diet believing that at the end of the diet, if they follow the plan perfectly, if they meet their weight loss goal, then that sweet, sweet rest will come. And I know for many of you, maybe you've been there already. Maybe you've met that goal, maybe a couple times, but it didn't work long term. And there's guilt and there's shame. And what ultimately is created is an even more tumultuous relationship with food. You feel bad because you quote unquote didn't stick to it. And why won't my body do what I want it to do? And the rest eludes you. And then we glom on shame around our inability to stick with the plan or to keep our food rules. And friends, let's just get real for a second. Most of us know all the tips and tricks. Are we really helping each other when we remind each other of the tips and tricks that we've seen on the internet? We know all the things. Yeah, a new one might come along every now and then, but chew gum when you're hungry. Drink a full glass of water before you eat. Vow to yourself not to eat at 7 p.m. Like, we know all the things. And my question is, how effective are they ultimately? Because I know for me personally, I had to focus so hard on all the things, and yet, still, I never felt like I could get it all together. Still, I was like, okay, I know what I'm supposed to do. I know what I'm supposed to do. I'm holding my breath. I know what I'm supposed to do. And I still couldn't make it happen. It is so much easier for us to believe that there is a version of ourselves that will get it all together. There's a version of ourselves that will someday be able to do all the rules and all the strategies perfectly, and then we'll have the perfect body someday.
it's much easier for us to believe that is true, that that ideal us, and remember, what did I say about ideals? That our ideals become idols, but it's much easier for us to believe the idol. It's much easier for us to believe in that ideal us than it is for us to question or challenge that some of these things we've been told about food and dieting and our bodies may be wrong. It's much easier for us to believe in magic than it is for us to believe that maybe there's something to the fact that we've got all these women that have the same shared experience, feel the same shame, feel the same frustration, have had the same journey. Maybe the problem isn't us. Maybe the problem is that journey. And yet we prefer to shame and scold ourselves for not being more like our ideal. We prefer that than operating in reality.
Oh, friend, it's getting good. Let's take a quick break and then I'll be right back in just a minute.
And some of you are saying, no, Heather, it's not about rest. That's not what I need. What I really just need is to be healthy. You don't know my list of health problems. I need to be healthy. I hear you. But please let me challenge you on this point too. Is always thinking about food, running on empty because you're trying not to eat, trying to remember what you're restricting, what's legal, trying to get your special food ready or keep your kids away from your special food, what is that doing to your mental health? What is that doing to your spiritual health? For me personally, I've had to come to the place where I recognize for my mental and spiritual health, dieting and restricting will never work for me again. Even if I lost some weight, even if the diet cured my thyroid disease, I would be way too unhealthy in the other ways that matter the most if I tried to go back to that. Here's my take on maybe a scripture that sounds familiar. If I can fit in a size 4 jeans but have not love, I'm a clanging cymbal. If I can get the praise of everyone for my weight loss but have no patience for my family because I'm hangry all the time, friends, I've missed it. And so with that as a preface, let's talk about this big trigger topic, emotional eating. As I think about what we're fighting against when we talk about emotional eating or eating when you're not necessarily physically hungry, there are two camps of thought that we kind of have to respond to. And the first camp is the church. And then the second camp is the health community, including diet companies. Now, I'm overgeneralizing. Not all churches have a position on this, right? And really, the church doesn't have a position on it. It's people within the church, right? But So we really don't have to respond to the entirety of these two groups. But I think these are the two main places where we have learned that emotional eating is bad. Now, most of you were on a call where we walked through biblically how I think this is problematic. I talked about how after Jesus's death and resurrection, he showed up in his pre-incarnate body and fed the disciples breakfast on the beach. Y'all, he fed them. They had Jesus. Shouldn't he have been all they needed? But what they really needed was some comfort. They were sad that Jesus was gone. They were sad that things hadn't worked out as plans. They were shocked and stressed and distressed because, like, what in the world just happened? Jesus wasn't supposed to die like that. Like, what? It had to have felt so overwhelming and traumatic and confusing for them. So when Jesus shows up, why didn't he just say, I'm here, you don't need anything else, friends? But what does he do? He feeds them. He feeds them breakfast. Food is a great act of care. Oh, friends, why do we dismiss that? God made our bodies to get some comfort from food. Food regulates and stabilizes us. Food tells our bodies that we are safe, and that's why it's often the first place we run to when we aren't sure of our safety. Now, here's where it gets more nuanced. But Heather, you say you can't always run to food. You have to run to Jesus. Running to food instead of Jesus isn't good. And I hear you. But the challenge there is it depends, because sometimes you're going to need some food and Jesus because he knows that's how he made our bodies. It's not competing with that. The nuance is that the food part shouldn't matter as much as it does. Like, why do we want there to be that dichotomy? Like, we don't have to have a food or God dichotomy. Why do we want it? I think we want it because of what diet culture has taught us, that the food is bad, that the food will hurt us, that the food will make our bodies fat. But that's not a dichotomy that God sets up. We have to reject that. Meeting our biological, physiological, even emotional need for food should not be in competition with going to our Savior for all of our needs. Those are two different things. Do you question your need to go to the bathroom? Does your need to go to the bathroom compete with your need for Jesus? How about your need for sleep? Do you worry that your need for sleep will bring you comfort that you should only get from Jesus? Now, let me carry that a little bit further. Can you sleep too much? Absolutely. The Bible talks about that, right? So deciding to sleep all day instead of doing what God has for me to do when I'm of able mind and body, like, that would be sloth. But where is the line? How do I determine where the line when I've crossed it into sloth is? My husband watches these guys on YouTube who sleep for like 4 hours a night so that they can be superpowers. My husband sleeps like 7 or 8 hours a night. I sleep 9 to 10 hours a night, and sometimes I still need a nap. So where is the line for how much sleep is too much? Is it more than 10 hours? Is it more than 8 hours? Am I getting too much? How do we know? Oh, friends, we know because sloth is not about the number of hours you sleep. It's about your heart. It's about your why. It's about what do you want to do with your life? It's about what are you a slave to? Right? And some of you have struggled with depression and maybe stayed in bed all day. That wasn't sloth. So the problem is, I can only tell when I am sinning in the area of my sleep by asking God to check my heart. Right? I can only know if I'm sleeping too much, if I'm not being industrious enough, if I'm being lazy. I can only know that by asking God to check my heart and asking the Holy Spirit to convict me. But there's not an exact number by which I'm going to cross and the alarm bell will go off. And in fact, I mean, the good gracious news is that, you know, some days I'm going to need more sleep and some days I'm going to need less sleep. So that's going to change. Let me take this analogy one step further, though. What happens if I decide to restrict my sleep? What if I decide that 10 hours of sleep is sloth and I need to, quote unquote, do better in the area of my sleep? I should have a couple more hours a day to do work for the kingdom. And I decide I'm going to restrict my sleep to the point where I am tired all of the time because I'm no longer getting those 9 to 10 hours of sleep that I thought I should get. What has happened to me? Well, probably what's going to happen is I'm going to start obsessing over how tired I am. Sleep will be all I can think about. I'm going to be daydreaming about going back to bed. I'm going to be so tired because I restricted my sleep that I'm no longer going to be useful for the kingdom. I'm just making it through the day till I can get back in bed. Sleep's importance actually becomes elevated in my life. Why? Because I decided to fight my body on what it needed. I decided that for the sake of not, quote unquote, sinning, I needed to restrict. And my body said, nope, that's not what we're going to do. My body said otherwise. Are you following me here? So back to food. Most of us want that like alarm bell to sound when we've crossed a line. Okay, now I know that's too much food. And especially if you've had an eating disorder or disordered eating background, it feels really uncomfortable to think about having food freedom because you immediately feel like you can't be trusted around food unless you have a line that you know not to cross. Maybe that's an amount of calories, an amount of meals, maybe that's a time frame that you're eating in. And you will say things like, I need healthy boundaries with food. And you believe that if you keep your leash short and your fences high, you will be safe with food and it won't dominate you. And then you won't fall into some sort of sinful state because you've got such good boundaries. You're keeping yourself safe. But what if we go back and say that again with sleep? Right? It's kind of silly. Like, it feels really uncomfortable to think about having sleep freedom because we immediately feel like we can't be trusted around sleep unless we have a line that we know not to cross. And we say things like, I need healthy boundaries with sleep. And we believe that if we keep our leash short and our fences high, we will be safe with sleep and it won't dominate us and lead us. That's ridiculous, right? But friend, food is just as much of a necessity in your life as sleep is. So then how do you know when you've eaten too much? You might not. You might have to eat too much and then you know because your body tells you. If your body doesn't tell you, it may be a signal that you need to get some help from someone who specializes in disordered eating and eating disorders. If you've been restricting for a long time, you may need help to listen to your hunger cues. And you may also need help as you go through a process called refeeding where you eat more and you may gain weight. If you've never restricted but still always felt like you weren't safe with food, a professional can help you sort that out too. But this is where we have to put our black and white thinking and our fears aside and remember that it is reasonable to be in a human body and safe around food and eating without food rules. Now that sounds completely unrealistic in our culture, but God made our bodies with the proper regulating mechanisms to teach us how to care for them. Granted, eating as much as your body wants may not make you look like a celebrity or model, but you already know that many of them have eating disorders. So why are you trying to emulate them anyway? My hope from these chapters was that it would challenge your thinking around what is healthy, because I've personally journeyed through so many health trends that it became obvious to me that I was being jerked around. It also became obvious to me anecdotally that healthy choices some people made worked differently for their bodies than they did for my body or for other people's bodies. We are bio-individual creatures with a mix of genetics, epigenetics, history, medical history, etc. It determines how our bodies will function and react. So back to emotional eating. You may think, but Heather, if you tell me I'm free to eat when I'm stressed or freaking out, I'll just eat all the time. And my response to you would be that if that's your fear, because that's really what it is, it's a fear, then the food is not the most important part of this challenge you have. If you're stressed or freaking out all the time, then let's not worry about the food. Let's worry about the underlying anxiety and the problem that really needs to be addressed. Of course, the food's not going to solve that for you. I'm not sanctioning or even promoting that food should be your only source of comfort when you're emotional. Oh, but friend, again, I want to break down the false dichotomy that it's God or food, that you have to make sure you're always running to God and not to food. I want to challenge the notion that you are strong enough physiologically to say no to food when you're really stressed out, because I don't know that you are. Your body needs a regulator. Food offers it. It's an easy regulator when other options aren't available. Like if you're in the hospital with someone or something unexpected just happened in your marriage and it's 1 a.m. and you can't call anyone. Yes, of course, get down on your knees and pray. Yes, of course, seek God's face. But also remember that his hand has provided you the good gift of food. It will nourish, strengthen, and stabilize your body so that you can handle the stress temporarily. No, it will not fix your marriage problems or heal your loved one, but it will help your brain relax so that you can make reasonable decisions about what else you need to do to cope. What if God designed your body to respond that way? Friends, that's what Jesus did for his disciples. And all the guilt and all the shame we felt over our stress eating, Friends, we live in a more stressful time than ever before. Here's one last illustration on this point, just to kind of prove that maybe even if you've got the most willpower in the world, you may not be able to stop stress eating at certain times. And here's my illustration. It's holding your breath. Have you ever told yourself you were going to hold your breath for a really long time? Like, oh, I'm going to hold my breath 4 minutes, 4 minutes. I'm going to go 4 minutes. And you try and you try and you try. And, you know, like, I don't know, maybe you make it to 90 seconds. And guess what happens? Your body takes over. And it's like, nope, you're breathing now. Right? What happened to your willpower? Oh, shame on you for not having the willpower to hold your breath longer. Oh my goodness, you should feel so guilty and shameful for not. No, that's ridiculous. Your body wants to keep you alive. Your body will regulate you if you don't do what your body needs. Your body will make sure it gets done. So one final thought here. But Heather, what if someone hears us and thinks it's a license to just eat all the time and all the things, and they really take it too far and they just eat all the time? Because my first response would be, back to point A, how far is too far? If you found that actual line in the Bible, I'd love to see it. But it's really looking like a gray area to me. And second, let's just make decisions based on wisdom. To sit on the couch and eat Cheetos all day would not be wisdom. And you all know that. But listen to this caveat. Unless, of course, you didn't have any money and that was the only food in your house, then it's a completely different scenario where choosing the Cheetos is the wisest way to stay alive. But let me paint another scenario for you. You choose to eat only vegetables. It sounds like it's much healthier than only sitting around eating Cheetos. You are far superior to that person. But what if the end result is that because of restricting the other macronutrients, all you can think about all day is food? Because you are not satisfied in your eating, you're almost useless as an ambassador for the kingdom because you are hungry, hangry, and thinking about food 24/7. So again, let's not operate in fear. Not fear of gaining weight, not fear of food, not fear of the opinions of others. Let's keep our eyes on our own plates. How you eat and what you eat is ultimately between you and the Lord. And only you know if there's disobedience, pride, or idolatry in the way. But again, that's not about the food or eating the proper amount of food. That's about your heart. So my encouragement to you is to just let food be food. As more of your focus shifts towards the Lord and away from food, which again is really only possible if you are fed enough to use your wise brain, your prefrontal cortex, because a starving body will only operate in fight or flight, and it cannot think logically around food. But as more of your focus shifts upwards, as you turn your eyes upon Jesus, food will lose its grip. Eventually, you will realize that cookies are fine, but they don't meet your needs. You don't become a slave to the cookies, but neither do you fear them, which is actually just the same as being a slave to them. You find peace with food, agency to trust your body and to make your own food choices, and the freedom to feed your body in such a way that you don't always have to be thinking about food. So yesterday I got a brand new book in the mail, and it's not a new book. It's from 1990. It's called Health, Money, and Love, Why We Don't Enjoy Them. It's written by an Anglican priest. It's probably out of print. But it caught my attention when I was looking for books on the Marriage Supper of the Lamb. And I thought, why not? So I ordered it, y'all, and it came yesterday, right after our conversation in Thursday afternoon group. And it's so fascinating because he talks about these very food and diet things that we've been talking about, but with far more colorful language. And what's interesting is he wrote this in 1990, right? So he talks about butter and cream and meat being demonized, but he doesn't talk about carbohydrates being demonized, which kind of further exemplifies how things keep changing. But his main point through the book is to show us, to point us to the gospel instead of religion, and to show us how we develop religions and really cults around things like food and money and health. Y'all, I didn't read this book before I wrote mine. So it's blowing my mind that the man uses this language and used this language 30 years ago. But he says, religion is something that human beings must get right in order to have a correct relationship with God. But when Jesus came, it was the end of religion. The good news is that Jesus' death, resurrection, finished religion for us. And yet, we keep trying to create our own religions. We create our own ways to be good enough for God. And that's why I don't even like to entertain the conversation of, shouldn't you be watching this or watching this because Jesus says to be a good steward? And no, it's a religion you are creating. So listen to what he says about food and health. The religions of health, money, and love, and of sex, romance, marriage, work, dieting, eating, jogging, and working out, they all function as mystery cults. They are presented to us as possessing a secret gnosis, a private knowledge to be carefully guarded by the elect and to be extended to the general run of humanity only after the most exacting initiation rites. And the reason for all the secrecy? Is to protect the religions from the profane reality of life, from the vulgar luck, which, if allowed even a moment's contact with them, will promptly upset their apple cart. Take crash diets, for example. The fact of the matter, of course, is that they are frauds. The only thing that can permanently change anyone's weight is a permanent change in eating and exercise habits. But because that profane reality must not be allowed to intrude upon the religion of dieting, the purveyors of that religion are always pushing some new gnosis, some till now unrevealed secret that, unlike all the previous secrets, will be the first one to deliver the goods. And for a suitable fee, the price of the latest book or the most recently touted program, they will initiate you into that latest mystery. To be sure, that one won't work either. But once you have bought the religious principle of crash dieting, it doesn't matter. You have been hooked into the perpetual necessity of being a guardian of mysteries rather than a dealer in facts. Therefore, you are always fair game, no matter what the facts, for any mystery that comes along next. Earlier in the book, I made the point that Christianity is not a religion, but rather the proclamation that God has gone ahead on his own and ended religion by accomplishing in Jesus, free of charge, whatever it was that religion was trying to do. He has closed the religion shop for good and simply handed over, not just to select cultists, but to absolutely everybody, all the goods that the shop advertised but never carried. And parenthetically, he explains in the book how it is available to everyone, but there is a cost if you reject it. So he's not saying that everyone's going to heaven. He's saying you have to accept Jesus' grace and believe. Let me leave you just one more funny thing he says as he talks about food. He says, which brings us naturally enough to the supremely silly religions of food that are now more popular than almost any others. Not that they haven't always enjoyed great vogue. One of the oldest beliefs of the human race, despite the plain hard fact that people need food to live and can, in reasonable health, digest almost anything that grows, walks, flies, or swims, is that food will kill you unless it is carefully religionized. Cucumbers, it was once believed, had to have their baleful qualities exercised by slicing off a heel and rubbing the ends together until they foamed. Eggplants had to be soaked in brine to remove their poison. Raw vegetables were bad for you, and raw meat was certain death. In our days, though, that list has grown beyond belief. Remember, this is 1990-ish. Or more correctly, beyond anything that could be accounted for except by belief. Salt, refined sugar, animal fats, red meat, all meat, hard liquor but not wine, hard liquor and wine have all come under the interdict, along with a host of demons with names like calories, cholesterol, and nitrosamines. People used to say grace before meals and dig in. Now they must sit down and recite the whole nutritional catechism before nibbling at the unsalted, undercooked veggies that are the only doctrinally correct items on the table. And what is the secret that lurks behind all the flannel-mouthed religiosity? What is the mystery that these devotees of Orthodox eating are guarding? Is it that there will be a new mystery long next week? And that the adepts of the cult of nutrition will mindlessly, but just as noisily, embrace it as the final article of faith? Olive oil was once bad for you as bacon grease because it was demon-possessed by just as many calories. But then it was discovered to be harboring angels called monounsaturated fats and promptly granted admission to the nutritional pantheon. By and by, some food theologian will probably prove that those angels have fallen and turned into demons again. But through all the revisions of the catechism, the true believers will never once doubt the newest revelation, even if it tells them to eat today what would have killed them yesterday. And friend, that's my point. Don't buy the religion of diets. We are free. The gospel has made us free. There's no way you can eat that will make you more or less acceptable to God. Oh, friend, I hope this frees you today. We have a real Savior, and it's not a diet. It's not a certain way to eat. It's not in avoiding certain foods. It's not in reaching a certain weight. It's not in wearing a certain jean size. Friend, that's all a religion that was created by man. You do not have to follow those religions for Jesus. Jesus just wants us to follow him. I hope that encourages you today. I hope something today has helped you stop comparing and start living. And hey, if you want more information around this, grab the book, the 40-Day Body Image Workbook, and decide to join us as we walk through it together this summer. I think you'll get a ton out of it. Thanks for listening. The Compare To Show is proud to be part of the Life Audio Podcast Network. For more great Christian podcasts, go to lifeaudio.com.
I'm Don Hawkins, inviting you to be encouraged with my weekly podcast, Encouragement for You. To subscribe, go to lifeaudio.com.